Next speaker, I'm pleased to introduce, is George Dragoski, who will be talking to us about post-galaxy GRB.
Thank you. Okay. So I'll tell you about properties of the host galaxies we know so far and what cosmology can tell us about them. And at the end, perhaps what GRBs can do for cosmology. Here is a partial list of collaborators. Some of the principal people are here, but many others have participated in different papers. As it was already pointed by Sri and others, the key importance here is getting redshifts, because that gives you all the physical quantities of interest later. If you're very lucky, you may catch OT when it's bright and get absorption redshift, but by and large, you have to wait until it fades to get the host galaxy redshift. The star formation rates and morphologies of host galaxies, and then offsets between transients and what you may want to call center of the galaxy, provide constraints for the models of what might be the progenitor population, as was already pointed out, and I'll say something about this. And the reason why we don't have many observational cosmologists attending these meetings is that gamma ray bursts are not yet cosmologically interesting. Galaxies are not very interesting, but they might become so. One of the obvious possibilities was brought up by Martin, that someday we'll find GRB at a really high redshift and probe the primordial intergalactic medium, but there is something else that I'll tell you about later today. So here is the summary, so you can go to sleep after this. These are the host galaxies, but this one has been demoted. It's probably not the right counterpart, and there are now six redshifts. I'm throughout ignoring the supernova 1998 BV in 0425. The more mathematically astute among you will notice that 0.5958 is not equal to 0.33 here, and I'll tell you more about that object. I indicated here which have been measured in absorption, which have been measured in emission. Emission is always the host galaxy emission, not emission lines from transient, of course. Absorption is intergalactic or interstellar medium, usually in the host galaxy. The sure cases are the first one, 0508, and then 0123, and partially 0703. So there are two ways to find host galaxies. One is you wait until the optical transient fades away, take another picture, and here is the good old 0228. This is a Keck image taken about 6 months after the burst, after it came back from around the sun. Here it is, the blob here. You see there is a little brighter here, and that's where optical transient is. A few days later, there was a space telescope image. Here it is, same orientation now. Let's zoom in. That's the star was right, here is the galaxy, and here is the optical transient, so angular resolution is better, but signal to noise is the same. The second way to find host galaxies is through the asymptotic magnitude of the light curve, and that's illustrated here in the example of 0508 from Josh Bloom's paper, and that works fairly well. When power laws start to flatten out and reach asymptotic level, that's what you have is a galaxy. And so that was done in a few cases, most notably the 0508 host galaxy, which as far as I know was only measured in this way because it's coincident with transient. And here is its spectrum, which does not have appreciable contribution from the optical transient. This is from Bloom et al. Apche letter. The emission line redshift is essentially identical to the absorption redshift that was measured originally. There's a usual strong O2 line. This should be 3727. And there is also a neon 3 line that may not be familiar to many of you, but it's seen in H2 regions where there are hot stars. It indicates presence of a population of stars with temperatures larger than 30,000 Kelvin, which sounds good for some of the models. Otherwise, this is pretty indistinguished galaxy, less than 0.2 L star today, and star formation rate only several solar masses per year. Speaking of star formation rate, which is obviously one of the key questions you want to have answered in the study, I'll give you here one transparency crash course on how does one measure these things. Okay, there are several star formation indicators for galaxies, and they all reflect massive star formation, and they all, therefore, depend very strongly on the upper end of the initial mass function, which in itself may depend on metallicity, which is something that's been debated in literature a lot, but you can fancy the scenarios in which you can make more massive stars when metallicity is lower, which would be good news for dwarf galaxies and protogalactic fragments that are retrograde in 5, but that's pure speculation. And all of these things are obviously sensitive to the extinction, the geometry of the extinction. So they come in two categories. They're emission line indicators from recombination lines, and they're continuum indicators. The emission line ones are all based on Rob Kennicott's semi-empirical calibration for nearby galaxies plus the case B recombination theory. And the primary one is H-alpha, which would work at redshift few tenths, and it's obviously not yet observed in any GRB host because they're all at high redshifts. The derivative of that is H-beta through Balmer decrement. That's only been seen in one case so far, infrared. The vast majority are done through oxygen doublets 3727, which will work around redshift of unity. But the problem is that this conversion between the flux of this line and star formation rate is highly uncertain. It's very noisy. At higher redshifts yet, one can use the Lyman alpha line, which unfortunately is very sensitive to absorption by dust, or then resonance scattering and then absorption. So perhaps more robust ways to use the UV continuum, which is direct photospheres of the young stars, and that's done at two fiducial wavelengths, 1500 and 2800 angstroms. The calibration of this is done strictly through stellar population synthesis models by Leiterer et al. And Madow et al. And it's maybe a little more robust because it doesn't depend on some of the problems here. However, note the difference that emission line estimators are more representative of the very recent, very massive star formation. The continuum ones can go longer in time. They sample star formation rate over a slightly longer time scale. So they need not agree. Here are some illustrations of this. This is 0703. The spectra were taken when the transient was still contributing something to the light, redshift 0.97. This is the regular optical spectrum. You see some absorption lines. I'll show you the zoom in. The O2 line, which serves as a star formation indicator for obvious reasons, is very strong. And then a far red spectrum, where we actually detect three of the Balmer lines, an O3 line here as well. And this is very noisy because it's out there where night sky emission lines dominate. So we've done three estimates of star formation rate for this galaxy from O2 line, from H beta, and UV continuum. These are prior to any extinction corrections. And you can see how much they vary. Sometimes we do quote formal errors, which are in the ballpark 10-20%, but in reality, I think you should think of all these star formation numbers as uncertain to maybe 50%. I mean, I think that's a more realistic number. So that's how it works. By the way, here is the zoom in on the absorption portion. At this time, the optical transient was contributing about one-third of the continuum light in this wavelength regime. So this is sort of 2.5 case of absorption redshift. Okay, I will now go through the new material, and I'll skip over some of the old stuff if I run out of time. So here is 980613. Old picture of the host galaxy. We have better images now. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to make one. The transient was discovered by Hjort et al. Then we found the host galaxy at the Keck. And here are some spectra. The early reductions were reported in GCN note. We now have better data. These are two independently taken spectra with different instrument setups, so wavelength scales are different. Don't be puzzled by the shift of the line. In the newer data, we also see a trace of the neon 3 line, much weaker now, and all this is night sky line derivatives. You can also see that, well, the 4,000 angstrom break gets to be in a really noisy part of the spectrum. So this seems to be like a very certain case. Here are the properties of the galaxy. They're fairly common for this redshift. Assuming cosmology they'll use throughout, the page note of 65, omega of 0.2, and lambda of 0, which is not to imply any prejudice against lambda. It's just convenient cosmology to use. This translates into various and sundry useful physical numbers. The isotropic gamma ray luminosity is unimpressive. It's one of the lowest. The magnitudes are 24-ish. the absolute magnitude of the galaxy in its rest frame corresponds to about L star today. This is a tricky conversion we always use because we can measure the luminosity of the galaxy then, and then it will evolve. We don't know how. Usually they fade out. And then we can compare them to L star today because we don't know what L star was back then. Okay, but that's what it is. And then using these two different ways of measuring star formation rates, we get of the order of 4 solar masses per year, of not corrected for any extinction. Now here is our new friend, 0828, that Dale introduced. At first we didn't really believe it because of the single appearance of the radio source, but now after 0123, we thought this is exactly the same case. The yellow circle is the Rosset localization of the fading ASCA X-ray source. The little red circle in the middle is the VLA source. I think this is 2 sigma error circle. The 1 sigma errors are approximately 1 pixel on the scale. This galaxy we call B1. This companion we call B2. Note that this falls kind of right in between them, and this may be a gap between galaxies or maybe a dust lane. The magnitude of brighter of the two is red magnitude is 24.5. This one is about magnitude fainter. So we now believe that this was indeed the correct counterpart, even though we had never seen the transient, and the reason for that will be explained later. Here is the spectrum. We didn't work hard on this last year because we weren't really sure about this. And it has very convincing O2 line. Then unfortunately, this is all night sky subtraction. I plotted here the night sky. You can just see from the intensity scale, it will be very difficult to do anything here. And this is a real line, which you can just see into the image. The others are obviously night sky derivatives, subtraction derivatives, which is obvious in 2D picture, but not in 1D cut. And unfortunately, the 4,000 angstrom break happens like right here in the middle of this mess. But you can visually see that flux here is about factor of 2 bigger than flux there. So there is also probable break. So I think the redshift is fairly secure. And assuming this redshift, this is the correct ID, the properties are shown here. The gamma ray isotropic energy is very impressive. It's comparable to good old 1214. The magnitudes are shown here, 25th, 26th. The inferred rest frame luminosity of the galaxy B1 is about 1/3 of the L star galaxy today. And the star formation rates are piddly 1 solar mass per year or thereabouts. Now, mind you, none of these numbers include any extinction corrections. Reddening is obviously, or extinction becoming an important subject, as several speakers have indicated. And the earliest case, really good case, was 980329. This is the K-band image taken at Keck by Larkin et al. And from the large ratio of peak brightness in radio to optical, and from large R-K color, we concluded that this is an excellent case for highly obscured bursts, which is why it was not caught early on. However, I should point out that this is certainly the case for the optical transient itself, and the Chicago group has written a very nice paper discussing all this. Here it's labeled as host galaxy, but in reality it's a combination of the host galaxy and the optical transient seen in K-band. We have detected a host galaxy at the red magnitude of 26 back then. We have now reobserved it in better conditions, 2 different epochs. And here is the comparison of R and I images taken with Keck in November and December of last year. As you can see, object is detected about equally poorly in both. The red magnitude is a little fainter than 26. The R minus I color is slightly negative, and it corresponds to the flat F of nu spectrum. In other words, the host galaxy is A, there, and B, it's blue. It's not red. It's an excellent example of how one line of sight, i.e. towards the optical transient, could be heavily obscured, whereas galaxies as a whole, or visible parts of the galaxy, are not. So right there you can exclude redshifts greater than 5, but we can do a little better than that. From our best spectra, we have many, many hours of this in different conditions, in different setups. I took the best data, I binned them and filtered them very heavily to show the continuum level. You shouldn't believe the zero point of this, but the point is that there is no break. There is no drop. If this was on any redshift greater than 4, you'll see a very clean cut drop. And so, from the absence of the breaks, we can put firm upper limit of 3.9 to the redshift of the source. We also do not see any strong emission lines, so usually one always sees 37-27, and so probably redshift is greater than 1.5, but that's, I think, very soft limit. We simply may have a dull object. So we do not have real redshift, but we have this bracket, and the galaxy is still quite faint. I wouldn't be surprised if it was something like a redshift of 2. I will skip quickly through 990123 because it's fresh in everybody's memory. Here is a Keck image taken in K-band. The pixels are 0.15 arc seconds. This shows the optical transient already faded and the host galaxy, which we call Galaxy A. And there is, of course, a much better STIS image. This is a reduction by Josh Bloom and Steve Otterwin. The cross indicates the astrometric position of the optical transient from ground-based data. As you can see, it's coincident with this source. Galaxies show somewhat irregular appearance, but you shouldn't think of this necessarily as being a merger or something like that, because K corrections can bring star-forming regions in view. But in any case, there is no reason whatsoever to assume that this is an active nucleus or something like that, that Andy Fruchter said. The subtraction of point source by Hjorth et al. Shows that there is a little knot of star formation perhaps right there. More importantly, there is no spectroscopic evidence for any nuclear activity. The magnitudes are listed here, and star formation is fairly moderate. Again, thus none of this includes any corrections for the extinction. We have spectra of this galaxy now taken with essentially an emission. I haven't had a chance to reduce them, but I believe we see 3727 line. This is the published spectrum of the absorption seen in the spectrum of the transient. One thing is worth noting here, well, two things. One is that lines are very strong. They're in top 10% or better of all magnesium absorbers. And the velocity spread is very small, suggesting a dynamically cold system. So this could be something like a largish LMC or smaller spiral of that redshift, and perhaps interacting, as it's not uncommon at these redshifts. How am I doing on time? Okay, I will really not spend any time talking about 1214, that used to be the record holder for isotropic gamma ray energy. Here is a space telescope image of the galaxy. Its spectrum, which I believe most of you probably have seen, it showed Lyman alpha line in emission, the hints of usual ISM absorption lines seen in Lyman break objects at comparable redshifts. And the properties of this galaxy are very typical for the Lyman break population at similar redshifts. It's about 15.5 magnitude red, 26.5 in V. The usual amount of emission line, approximately an L star object at that redshift in units of present day L star. Star formation rate, about 5 solar masses per year from continuum, only 1 solar mass per year from Lyman alpha, and this is what you expect because Lyman alpha line is eaten up by dust. So DEP2 was indistinguished galaxy for its redshift. One interesting result about that is that there is a small but significant offset between the optical transient position, which is in the middle of the circle, and the center of the host, shown here. This is luminosity-weighted centroid, and that's described in the APCHE letter by Otterwin et al. Okay. So I'll just show you one more picture, and then I'll talk about where do these galaxies fit in the cosmological context. Here is 980519. The host galaxy is, again, red magnitude 26.2. This, by the way, means that blue magnitude is probably about 28. So it's one of the two faintest so far, the other one being 0329. We've taken several hours of spectra on this in excellent conditions, and there were no strong emission lines. But I'm not too surprised at this magnitude level, even with Keck. This is extremely hard work. With Keck, you can do well up to a red magnitude of 25 or so. Beyond that, it gets really difficult, too. So that was just a quick sampler of what these galaxies look like. I'll now put them in their cosmological context. How do they compare with normal galaxies? Well, here is a simple plot. It shows differential R-band galaxy counts from Hogg et al., et al., including Roger Blanford, Judy Cohen, Mike Parr, and others perhaps. And this is a log-log diagram. This is corrected for incompleteness. I put bars wherever the magnitude is for given host. This one is probably not a GRB. This is an upper limit. And the obvious thing is that these galaxies have the magnitudes that you expect them to have on average on the sky. Another interesting note to this is that there is no correlation between gamma ray flux and redshift, just like for radio sources, just like for any other kind of non-thermal radio source, non-thermal source. So the faint magnitudes are not surprising at all. Upper limits in some cases like 0326 are also not surprising, considering there are a few more fainter galaxies out there. And there is no host galaxy problem. What about their line emission? Well, here are the rest frame equivalent widths of O2 line for four objects that are around redshift of 1, indicated as red circles. And this is just the bulk of the population from deep field survey by the Caltech team and Hogg et al. Paper. As you can see, these are perhaps somewhat above the average for the redshift, but not factors of few higher than average. Again, hint, star formation is going on, but it's not fantastic relative to other galaxies in the redshift. Another way to look at this is where do these four around redshift of unity fit on the oxygen line emission luminosity function at redshift of several tenths. And as you can see, they're right around the knee of the luminosity function, which is exactly what you would expect if you had a few galaxies selected at random from field. Okay, so as far as the photometric properties are concerned, these galaxies are no way different from average field galaxies at same redshifts. There is one other piece of useful information that we can learn from imaging of these objects, and that is the offsets between transients and the centers of the galaxies, such as they are. And for the five best measured cases, here are the points. This shows offset in arc seconds. The two lines are the median half-light radii for deep space telescope samples by Audouin et al. Taken in these two filters, which kind of bracket the R magnitude. As you can see, it doesn't really matter. And so the immediate conclusions from seeing this plot are, one, is that GRBs are not located in the cores of, in centers of their host galaxies, with one exception, 0508. And two, they're separated by the amounts roughly comparable to the projected half-light radius, maybe a little less. Now, in 3D, it's perhaps actually the projection factor takes care of it. So in other words, they're associated with stellar extent of their host galaxies, not with nuclei, not with large extended dark halos. How does this compare with models? There have been three interesting papers on this that I know about. And I xeroxed this from a paper by Mao and Mo, where they used actual luminosity function, et cetera, to predict what do you expect to see in terms of host galaxy properties. They make some interesting predictions. First is that the redshift distribution should peak around redshift of 1. These are the three redshifts they had. I added more. And as you can see, they're about right. There is a strong redshift selection effect if there are no strong emission lines around between redshift 1.5 and 2.5. It's hard to measure redshifts there. So that can easily account. So that qualitatively looks good. They predict I-band magnitude distribution. This is roughly R minus 0.5. This is the observed range. As you can see, that's pretty much correct. Two other papers by Hogg and Fruchter and Krumholtz, Thorsett, and Harrison addressed these issues. Hogg and Fruchter explored three possibilities, that GRBs are proportional to star formation rate, to total stellar mass, but the rate is constant in time. And the answer is that they couldn't distinguish between these three models on the basis of six data points until now, five in their paper. Yes, I should point this out. I'm not sure what they do in the latest reincarnation of their preprint, but I think in the past they used Madao's old diagram, whereas these guys used the new Seidel version of it, with which Pierre Madao also agrees, I think. Another important point made by Krumholtz et al. Is that you just cannot distinguish these things on the basis of handful of redshifts we have so far. You need at least 30 or so in order to make semi-meaningful answer to this. So once we have 30 or 50 of host galaxies well measured, we might be able to constrain a little bit whether GRBs correlate directly with star formation rate or not. So summarize part so far before I go to the last item of my talk, which is the extinction. What we have learned about host galaxies and what do they tell us about theoretical models? They're perfectly normal for their normal field galaxy population, not unusually high in star formation rate, not peculiar in morphologies, I mean, not more than any other galaxies at the same redshifts. They may be just slightly underluminous, perhaps, maybe not. There is no spectroscopic or imaging, for that matter, evidence for active galactic nuclei. In fact, I can tell you, there are no active galactic nuclei in any of these hosts, for sure. The offsets are telling us several interesting things. They're typically of the order of half-life radius, therefore they're associated with stars. They're not associated with nuclei, massive black holes. They may or may not be associated with star-forming regions. We can't tell that yet. We'll take many more space telescope pictures. And they're not associated with very extended 100 kiloparsec galaxy halos. So some of the ejected neutron star type models do not work, but others might work, like black hole neutron star. Prof.
When you say they are only slightly underluminous, because it's about a half L star today, of course L star, that's just one, as you said earlier, was different. Is there a rough idea of what L star at redshift of 1 was?
Yeah, there is a rough idea. The rough idea is that typical fading may be a factor of 2-ish. For Hubble sequence galaxies, maybe 50% or so. For dwarfs, more than that. Okay, so all this is consistent with the models that involve massive stars or their remnants, but does not prove any of them, of course. So it's sort of good news, but we have ways to go. Now, on to my last item, and that's question of extinction. Sri has already addressed this very well, and here is an example of 0703. Where from the shape of the light curve, Bloom et al. Measure A of V of 0.9 for the transient itself, whereas from the spectroscopy of H2 regions, we figure out AV of 0.3. Now, these two need not coincide because it's a particular line of sight to the optical transient, and given the fractal nature of the interstellar medium and dust, the RMS of different extinction values will be comparable to the mean value itself. So that's what you should expect. And another thing that's not always appreciated is that if the dust is optically thin, you'll see reddening as well as the extinction. Whereas if it's optically thick, it merely absorbs light, so it doesn't get any redder, it just gets transferred to far infrared, so it gets dimmer but not redder. So that tells you that you can't just use a thin slab of ISM in front of your source and then derive things. It's a much more complicated situation than that. Fortunately, somebody has done this correctly, and that's Daniele Calzetti has studied extinction in starburst galaxies, and she finds that there is an excellent correlation between the slope of the UV continuum, which is all just massive stars, and they all have the same spectrum always, so the slope changes are due to dust alone. She usually does it for 1,500 or 1,600 angstroms. At my request, she kindly computed the same thing at 2,800 angstroms. As you can see, there is a superb trend between the extinction and the slope in now f of lambda. This is the Rayleigh-Jeans limit, clearly. And one has to multiply this amount for gas by 0.44 to get effective stellar, because it's different geometry. I can't really explain this now. And for three bursts I indicated here, these are the values. And our new friend, 0828, is outside this diagram. And here it is, all four of them. So from Calzetti's starburst curve, we find out that 0828 has rest frame visual magnitude in about 2.2 visual magnitudes extinction, which, of course, when we see it in ultraviolet in our observed frame, it will be much higher yet. So here, I think, is the best direct evidence that we have so far for actual extinction in host galaxies, which is correlated with, but not perfectly, with extinction towards optical transients. And OA28, I think, is a now poster child of transients lost to extinction. To be specific, what this does, here I translated now these extinction numbers into corrected star formation rates and blue luminosities, and this is very preliminary still, but you can see that for the low extinction cases, the star formations go up by a factor of 2. For higher extinction cases, they can go up by a couple tenths, and now the two indicators, oxygen 2 line and magnesium and continuum, agree much better. So 0703 is still the record holder for star formation rate, several tens of solar masses per year. And blue rest frame luminosities now climb up by similar factors, well, factors of 2-ish. And if you fade these things down by a factor of 2 till the present day, you'll get something which you might expect for normal galaxy population. So everything is fine. I was saying, great, here there are these large star formation rates. Well, not quite so fast. By the way, here is the same story for the high redshift object 97-12-14 using different Calzetti estimator at 1600 angstroms, and again, similar correction factor. But all other galaxies are also subject to the same correction, so these guys are not exceptional. All galaxies in the field on average are corrected by the same amount, and that's illustrated best in Karamadawa's diagram, which shows co-moving density of star formation rate before any corrections. You've all seen this, I'm sure. And now, using very simple, modest, conservative correction for extinction, they all climb up on a factor of 2 around redshift of 1, larger factors at higher redshifts. Which leads me to the one final thing I want to say, and this is what gamma-ray bursts can do for cosmology. There is a great deal of activity now in trying to decide how much of all star formation in the universe was obscured and what gives rise to the cosmic infrared background. So there is connection between gamma-ray bursts and cosmic infrared background. This was the synoptic plot, again taken from Adao, showing energy per unit decade for the optical background, actual measurements by Bernstein, the only real measurements, lower limits from galaxy counts, and measurements from COBE. This was done by three different groups using same data set. They get three different answers that differ by a factor of 2 or 3, which indicates the difficulties of this game. So you can just visually say that approximately equal amount of energy was in unobscured and obscured star formation in the universe, although whether it was factor of 2 or 3 in either direction is subject to much debate nowadays. And Lilly and company plot diagram of evolution of bolometric luminosity with redshift for unobscured things and obscured scuba sources, and again, the answer is comparable amounts of obscured star formation. What can gamma-ray bursts do? The answer is obvious, you can count them. Many people have shown this diagram, so here they are. And I counted now just those where we have actually done good search for optical transients and haven't found any. I've been very liberal in actually counting them. So there are about 9 out of a sample of 13 that one should count. In other words, 70% of the cases where we had a fair chance of finding a transient, we have found one. Number that I think Sri has pointed out. And then again, there are all different reasons why they can be missing, so the 30% non-detection rate is strict upper limit on how many are lost to extinction. They can be all lost due to the fact that they decline fast, they intrinsically faint, the bad weather all over. I mean, this is not a trite matter. If a burst goes on in December in northern sky, there are good chances that nobody will get good data on it. Okay? So this is a rigorous upper limit, and to the extent that optical transients or gamma-ray bursts follow star formation rate in galaxies, then this is telling us in a completely independent way from all other cosmological studies what fraction of all star formation ever was obscured, and the answer is maybe 1/3, barely. And incidentally, it's exactly the amount that we know is true at zero redshift from IRAS studies. So models that say that 5 times more of obscure star formation at high redshift and so on can't possibly be right. So here is one thing that gamma-ray bursts can actually do for cosmology. Thank you.
Thank you, George. We have time for a few questions. Martin.
George, your last argument does depend on the gamma-ray bursts not having escaped from there. So if they're they had run away from this, we don't think that.
It goes in the same direction, right? Because that will be yet another reason why we haven't seen the transient. I'm just counting whether or not transient was seen, regardless of whether or not it's associated with the host galaxy.
If they typically escape from dense
regions. I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's true. However, in the cases that we actually do see both galaxies in the burst, which is every time we had a good enough data to look, they're at half-light radius of the galaxy. One possible case where this may have happened is 0326, as pointed out by Sri. There is no host galaxy, maybe one of those that are 5 arc seconds away, but that doesn't seem to be very likely. Every time we can actually get the right data, we see that transient is within half-light radius of the host galaxy.
And I'll stop here for this point, which is that this very strong optical and UV emission beginning to evaporate dust very much differently. So even if it does occur in a dusty region, it could have been obscured, you could actually evaporate from the dust.
Yeah, but depends how far, right? I mean, that could have been the case of 0508. You remember we were discussing that possibility early on, why it had a peculiar light curve.
No, but I'm talking about the early flash. Early flash of 10 seconds is typical, then it could do it for most of the years.
Okay, well, the numbers are also, of course, still very small, but it shows the path, what we can actually do in future. Rob?
Yeah. I guess the other caveat, so following up on these comments that Mike remarked, there could be, in fact, the opposite side, that you always have to be a little mindful of, and also an issue of evolution of sort of afterglow properties with redshift, and that is the business that the both the speed, the time scale on which the afterglow occurs and its peak magnitude depend on the external density at the 1/2 power. So conceivably, things that escape from red galaxies are underrepresented in the sample of things that we locate via optical.
Yes, but that's an entirely hypothetical argument because, again, one thing that we learn from offsets is they do not escape from their host galaxies.
But that's what I'm saying. If they do escape from their host galaxies...
Well, then fine. A few years from now, if all of a sudden population of SKPs shows up...
I'm just telling you that because if they are in low-density regions, they may not have strong optical afterglows.
What about X-ray?
Yeah.
Similar X-ray afterglows would...
Yeah, or radio. Or radio. The fact that there are radio afterglows where there is no optical counterpart or barely optical counterpart really suggests that it's de-extinction. So radio surveys are crucial to do this.
Yeah, I agree.
Other questions?
Hello, my point was that X-ray afterglow is produced by basically the same medium as optical afterglow.
Yeah.
Just somewhat closer to the source. There are only two exceptions after X-ray afterglow is clear of the scene. So there is very little room for hiding things which are at low density as usual.
In the long books.
It is the absence of optical in the face of the presence of X-ray.
Right.
Is the important thing.
Yeah. There is also a large dynamical range of optical to X-ray flux ratios at the peak that can perhaps be used to firm up this in terms of the face of extinction. Yes.
Avi?
Sounds like the issue of dust obscuration is resolved by infrared observation. I was wondering why.
Oh yes, our friend Andy Fruchter had many plans. There is infrared and there is infrared. That infrared is not far enough to actually make a real difference. If you had arc second resolution mid to far infrared telescope in space, that would be beautiful, right? But that's not going to happen anytime soon. I mean, the re-emission wavelength for this is 50 to 100 microns in the rest frame. So you want to be able to sample this at 200 microns. And of course, people try with SCUBA and so on, and CSO, and there were only upper limits, really. So we do not have technology yet. It would be, of course, the right thing to do.
I have one more question. That was in the 980329 case where you showed the Keck spectra that must have taken many, many hours to get. You showed up to, I believe, about something longward of 6,000 angstroms and onward. and presumably the, you know, as the flux is decreasing in the blue and you couldn't get the spectrum short, were 6,000?
No, we knew that it was red because of the early afterglow studies, so we only observed spectroscopically in red part of the spectrum. This is one kind of data which we take.
That's
with
for the afterglow, and I thought the point that you were making was that the afterglow colors and the galaxy colors are not necessary.
Yes, but we didn't know this until a month ago.
Okay. But in principle, you could,
if
you wanted to take your brains out, you could go back there and try to...
Oh, exactly. This was what we'll be doing in the future. I'm sorry. Yeah, because we observed it only in the red because we expected it to be red, and it was a real surprise that it turned out to be blue, both spectroscopically and photometrically. So now, of course, we'll start from 4,000 angstrom up.
Is the decrease from 7,000 shortward to 6,000?
Oh, you shouldn't believe that. No.
But if RM and NICMOS edge is not very dark.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Thank you. Any other questions? Let's thank George again.